Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate Republicans are pushing for a vote on their health care bill as early as next week, but few know what's in it because negotiations are taking place behind closed doors. Last night, Democrats held a protest talkathon on the Senate floor to try to slow down the process. Joining us now, Senator Claire McCaskill. She's a Democrat from Missouri. Senator, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, why are you and your colleagues trying to slow down this process of the Republicans trying to pass a health care bill in the Senate?
I really don't think this is a matter of slowing them down. It's a primal scream of trying to point out to America that this is unprecedented. I think many people have forgotten the long, open process we had on the Affordable Care Act that went on for months and dozens of hearings and hundreds of amendments and many, many hours of C-SPAN watching of the various hearings to try to hammer out a new way of trying to attack the health insurance problems in America. And this is couldn't be further from that. This is a group of guys in a back room somewhere that are trying to change dramatically the healthcare policy in this country, and we all are just beside ourselves that we're not being allowed to talk about it, to see it, to offer suggestions, to ask questions, and that's really what you see going on here. We're trying to go to extraordinary efforts to point out to everyone that this truly is unprecedented.
Do you think that the bill that they are talking about right now is pretty close to what the House passed?
Well, we don't know. We hear rumors. We are very uninformed about what they're proposing to do. We're pretty sure it's still a big tax cut for wealthy people in exchange for cutting dollars going into health care in this country. That is the premise around which all of this is being built, that we can cut Medicaid in this country significantly in order to give a tax break, a tax cut to the 1% in this country. And that, frankly, is one of the reasons that we are so upset. There's things we need to do to fix the individual markets, to make them more stable and secure, to try to bring down healthcare costs even more. But this is not the answer.
Do you think that this bill will get a vote next week as they're proposing?
I believe that they will have a vote. I'm not sure they have the votes to pass it. The only rationale I can think of that Mitch McConnell wants to keep all of this a deep, dark secret is that they know how unpopular it's going to be, and they want to leave as little time as possible for the people of this country to express their opposition to this.
There's been some analysis that today's special election in Georgia could play into this whole debate over the Senate health care bill, because if Karen Handel manages to win, maybe Republicans would be more willing to support it. Do you see that? Do you see any connection between those two things?
Well, I hope not. I think this election in Georgia has got taken on an outsize importance that probably shouldn't be as translatable as either side might want to make it. It is a Republican district. The Secretary of Health and Human Services under President Trump, who is boldly supporting Trump Care, won that district by 26 points. So if it's close, then that should send a message, I believe, to people in on the other side of the aisle that, you know, folks aren't happy with what's going on with health care in this country right now. But it is one district, and we're all looking at it because we're looking for some kind of signal that there's been some kind of shift in the electorate. But the bottom line is what I think most people in my state want is they want us to work together and get something done, repair what we have, rather than cutting health care dollars to give rich people a tax break.
Senator, one more question. We've heard the news about the death of Otto Warmbier, who was held in North Korea and just recently returned to the U.S. What do you think the U.S. response should be because of that?
Well, this is really hard. I am outraged at the treatment that this young man received. No question the North Korean government is complicit in his death. I hasten to say that it would not surprise me if the only reason he was released was because they realized he was going to die, and they wanted to remove him from the country before that happened. We have other people that are being held there, but this is when you need a strong, stable leader in this country that understands the ramifications of every foreign policy missive that comes out of the administration. We have to be careful here because we don't want to declare war on the Korean peninsula. And I think that this is when we've got to really speak with one voice, one stable voice, not a commander-in-chief who changes his mind like he changes his shirts about foreign policy, because the rest of the world is watching and wanting us to exercise the kind of stability they've come to expect from the United States of America. I think we need to be very careful in terms of making broad statements about how we're going to take care of it. I don't know what that means. But I know that many of us are very concerned about the lack of consistency that we're showing on the world stage right now.
That's Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Now to a study that showed that nearly 40% of American universities in a recent national survey reported they're getting fewer applications from overseas. And university administrators say it's because of concerns about President Trump's campaign rhetoric and policy proposals. And they say lower foreign student enrollment is likely to hurt their campuses and American industry. Adolfo Guzman Lopez from member station KPCC has the view from Los Angeles.
Manoj Sampanji Ram is in his first year in the Masters of Engineering program at California State University, Long Beach. He heard those concerns about Trump last fall from his friends back home in India.
Many of my friends were planning to apply here, but when Trump won, they all backed out.
Why?
Why? Because his rules are very strict for H-1Bs, maybe for students.
He's talking about the visas that allow foreigners to work in this country. President Trump wants to put limits on those visas. That worries Sampanji Ram. But for the time being, he's soaking up the training to learn as much as possible about design and manufacturing. He and a classmate power up a saw to cut a carbon fiber sheet they designed and made.
We're cutting into small pieces, putting in the testing machine.
Cal State Long Beach head of international programs, Terrence Graham, says applications from China are down 9%, from Iran down 24%, and from India down 42%.
So we did get emails from concerned students from India saying, you know, should I finish my application? Is there any point in me planning to come? And we try to assuage those concerns. We have heard from students from Iran, and Iran has consistently sent significant numbers of students to Cal State Long Beach and to the United States in general, but concerns certainly there with a lot of the rhetoric about the travel, the executive order.
Officials at Cal State Fullerton and the University of California, Riverside, say they're hearing similar concerns from some of the same countries and are seeing similar drops. International students make up about 70% of graduate students in engineering at Cal State Long Beach. Administrators say that's because so few U.S.-born students apply. A drop in foreign student enrollment could reduce class offerings and would mean fewer graduates, says Farooqzan Golshani, dean of the College of Engineering.
Probably we can adjust. However, the workforce will be impacted much more significantly. The reason is that we have relied on foreign-born American-educated graduates, both in industry and also at the faculty ranks in the academy.
If foreign applications continue to drop, Golshani says, American public schools will need to do a better job getting students interested in science, technology, engineering, and math careers.
Within the United States, many, many more of our U.S.-born students have to choose to go to STEM and have to choose to do a graduate program and a doctoral program in order for us to have an adequate workforce in these areas in the years to come. Otherwise, we will fall behind.
Cal State Long Beach's International Programs Office says it's trying several things to counter the application drop. The office created online videos to reassure overseas applicants that Southern California is a tolerant place where they are welcome.
My name is Ayub Elbriki. I'm from Morocco.
My name is Kelly Horn, and I'm from Canada.
Hi, I'm Manika Nuja, and I'm from India.
This campus has nearly 2,000 students from abroad earning a degree, among the highest number of all 23 Cal State universities. International students pay about double in tuition and fees compared to a California resident, and $1,200 more than non-resident students, so the drop could affect the university's budget. International Programs Executive Director Terrence Graham says drops in Asian and Middle Eastern applications has prompted him to send recruiters to places they rarely go.
For example, looking at Africa, looking at some other regions that we might not have been putting as many resources into, so that we're less susceptible to those political sort of ups and downs that are part of this this business.
But even in those countries, Graham says, his staff will likely get similar questions about whether it's safe to study in the U.S. and whether government policies will allow them to stay and work after graduation. For Here and Now, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez in Los Angeles.
Think for a minute about all the technology you use. Smartphone, laptop, TV, air conditioner, they all need semiconductors, the building blocks of computer chips. Back in the mid-80s, an epidemiologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst heard from a worker at nearby Digital Equipment Corporation that there were many miscarriages at the plant making semiconductors. That observation led to one of the biggest occupational health studies ever. It showed, while not harmful to consumers, the chemicals used were toxic to workers. And, well, let's bring in Cam Simpson of Bloomberg Businessweek to pick up the story. Cam, Harris Pestides is now the president of the University of South Carolina, but he was that epidemiologist in the 80s. Tell us more.
You know, as a sort of an expert in disease clusters, he was quite skeptical about the idea that, you know, there were elevated miscarriages at the plant. But then he did a pretty significant study and made kind of an irrefutable connection between the women's work and their miscarriages. There was a doubling of miscarriage rates in the plant. He did this through health records and interviews. And then there was a very obvious suspect for what was causing the miscarriages. One of the nastiest reproductive toxins known to science was a very common ingredient in making the chips, like you say, that are in our smartphones and our computers. And so the semiconductor industry, then it was really the birth of the modern information technology era, and it was huge and powerful. They weren't too happy with his results, even though they'd been paid for by Digital Equipment. And so they commissioned two more massive studies. And usually in epidemiology, you get conflicting results or at least equivocal results. By 1992, these two studies not only confirmed his results, but made them even stronger. And a study at IBM, at two plants IBM owned, showed a tripling of miscarriage rates for women who specifically handled these chemicals.
Well, and these industry leaders were tough, they were skeptical, but they had to go with this research. And so, as you write, it led to changes that helped generations of women. Pestides, the epidemiologist who started it all, said, it's almost a fairy tale in public health. But what?
Right.
What did you find?
Well, but it kind of was a fairy tale, unfortunately. I mean, it is one of the greatest stories in public health that you can do the scientific research and it can lead to eliminating these chemicals from production and helping all these women. But at exactly the same time that was happening, exactly as IBM and the other big technology companies in America said that they were ridding their production of these chemicals, they were quietly moving their production to Asia. So in 1995, IBM had two massive contracts that it secretly negotiated with what are today two of the biggest semiconductor makers in the world, Samsung Electronics and a company called SK Hynix, and they're giants. And, you know, we found that another epidemiologist years later in South Korea, Dr. Kim Myung-hee, she did a similar test after focus groups showed women reporting all kinds of reproductive health issues in these plants. And she found the miscarriage rates were almost identical to what they had been in the United States two decades earlier. And then what we did was we dug, and I was able to find test results from chemicals used in the plant that showed exactly the same chemicals were still being used in 2009, and then again in a smaller South Korean semiconductor maker in 2015. So you have generations thousands of women, untold thousands, who potentially could have been exposed, would have been exposed to these chemicals that cause miscarriages, infertility. They cause birth defects in every animal species that's ever been tested.
Look, so this was outsourced, this danger, to Asia. But as you point out, authorities would end up designating more Superfund hazardous waste sites in Santa Clara County, which is the heart of Silicon Valley, than in any other county in the U.S. Underneath Intel, for instance, they found these Superfund sites because of these chemicals. There is so much here. We'll link people to your reporting. But where are we now? Is it like whack-a-mole that we just have to get rid of the chemicals in these chips? Or is it impossible to make these chips?
Impossible. Yeah. It's completely impossible. I mean, that's one of the things that you discover when, you know, you dig into this, which is it's not actually an electronics business. It's a chemicals business. You know, chip manufacturers are chemical printing presses. There are 430 different chemical products used in a semiconductor plant that makes these things. And so many of them, I mean, more than 100 of these chemical products contain carcinogens, mutagens, which change your genes, and reproductive toxins.
And by the way, these women workers, they wore protective gear and gloves, but that was to protect the chips.
Exactly.
The chemical toxins went through those fabrics and poisoned these women. What happens? We know that there have been a lot of lawsuits settled, a lot of money paid out by the industry. What's going to happen going forward?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, you know, the U.S. technology companies have been secretly settling these lawsuits for the last 20 years. We found 66 cases that have been filed since 1997, and there was a secret settlement as recently as 2015. Now, one thing that has helped is the automation of chip making in Asia. So there's less physical contact. It hasn't been eliminated, but the chances for exposure have been lessened by automation. But the plants that still aren't automated never really go out of business. The demand for chips just goes up and up and up. So while the bigger companies automate more to make more money, which reduces exposure, the smaller lines that produce chips the old-fashioned way, by hand essentially, more exposure is still happening. So I think, you know, we need to end secrecy in the chip-making business. Supplying the chemicals alone is a $20 billion business, and the ingredients in the barrels that are used in these plants are often kept secret in Asia. You know, we have to sort of figure out how we can finally stop this and stop exposing women needlessly to such a known danger. I mean, these are the most dangerous reproductive toxins known to man. The science is a slam dunk. There's no sort of he said, she said. These are among the most serious toxins known to science. It's pretty clear.
Cam Simpson, Senior International Correspondent at Bloomberg Businessweek, will link you at hereandnow.org. Cam, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
Well, states are facing a shortage of teachers. One study from the Learning Policy Institute finds it was as big as 60,000 teachers in 2015. One reason? Low teacher pay. And the pay gap between teachers and administrators is wide enough that educators are often leaving the classroom behind. Lee Hale from member station KUER in Salt Lake City has this story.
A big chunk of Spencer Campbell's day sounds like this.
Liam!
Yeah?
Go back to the gym.
Oh.
Don't act like you didn't hear me.
No, I heard you. I'm coming.
Oh, okay. Where's your buddy? Who was that, Parker?
Campbell is one of two assistant principals at Elk Ridge Middle School in South Jordan, Utah, just south of Salt Lake City. He's in his late 30s and looks like an administrator. Dresses well, brisk walk. Last year, Campbell was teaching 9th grade English at a school up the road. Now he spends a lot of time walking the halls, checking breezeways for students playing hooky, walkie-talkie on his belt.
Spencer?
Yes, ma'am.
Is there any way you can go to Mr. Fife's room?
Yep, I'm on my way.
We turn a corner to find a restless 7th grader who's been sent out of class for being disruptive. These two clearly know each other well.
Seriously? We just had this talk.
He escorts the student to a study room and helps him get started on some worksheets.
Dude, you already started this.
For a moment, Campbell looks like a teacher again, a job he really loved. Before he taught, he ran a small business and did very well for himself, but he felt drawn to education. He went back to school for a master's degree and spent 5 years teaching in the classroom. But his salary didn't match his experience.
I mean, as a teacher, I was making $43,000 a year, and I had a part-time job where I would work another 20 hours a week. And that wasn't for the extras. That was just for the basics.
When he says extras, he's talking about things like braces for his kids. piano lessons, the occasional vacation, pretty standard desires for a parent. And so he felt like he only had one option, administration.
There's not a step in the ladder between teacher and administrator. That's it. It's just teacher and administrator.
That's not saying Campbell is upset about his job. He likes his job, and he's good at it. He now makes $83,000 a year, nearly double what he made in the classroom. But what he does now is just not the same as teaching.
The effect that a classroom teacher has on a student is second only to a parent. And as an administrator, I don't know if I'll ever be able to have that same effect. Like, that's kind of heartbreaking.
He was a phenomenal teacher. Phenomenal.
This is AJ Steele. He teaches ninth grade geography at Campbell's old school. Their classrooms were next door to each other.
Anytime somebody like that leaves the classroom, I think it's a huge blow to not just our little world, but I mean, the ripple effect, you know, that's one less amazing teacher a kid has.
But Steele understands why Campbell left, and he knows the job of an administrator is critical. But that doesn't explain what he refers to as the greatest mystery in education.
Why is it that the further away you get from kids, the more money you make? And I think that's the issue.
The problem is that there is a big disparity between what teachers make and a living wage in lots of places.
Janice Voorhees is the president of the Jordan District School Board, the district where both Campbell and Steele work. And she says the district is trying to address this problem. They recently approved a salary increase that includes an additional $7,000 for beginning teachers. And they're working on a plan to create a better, classroom-friendly career ladder, an opt-in program that mixes teaching, mentoring, and administrative responsibilities.
Here is another avenue to earn additional money so that you can stay in the classroom, be a deep, profound influence on student learning, and still feed your family.
But Voorhees isn't sure how long that will take, or if it will even happen, which leaves some of the most dynamic educators, like Spencer Campbell, spending their days patrolling hallways. For NPR News, I'm Lee Hale in Salt Lake City.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
American Airlines has canceled dozens of flights out of Sky Harbor International Airport in Phoenix today because of extreme heat. The flights affected use Bombardier CRJ aircraft. According to a statement, those planes have a maximum operating temperature of 118 degrees. Today, it's expected to hit a high of 120 degrees. Joining us for more is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, co-host of Velshi and Rule, and also a private pilot in training. Hi, Ali.
Jeremy, good to talk to you.
And why can't this particular plane operate above 118 degrees? What problems does it cause?
Well, think about a plane flowing, traveling through air in the same way that you think about a boat traveling through water. The plane needs the air in order for it to fly. It needs the air to go through its engines. It needs the air to go over the wings. As air gets hotter, it gets less dense. We all know that from our science classes. So a plane needs more ground to take off. If the air is hot, it means more ground to land. It's harder to climb. The performance of the plane is generally not very good. So rule number one on these planes, these Bombardier planes, is that the operating procedures say don't operate above 118 degrees. And the first rule for a pilot is when the manufacturer says that, just don't do it. So that's rule number one. But it just planes don't perform well in the heat or at altitude. And they both do the same thing. They make the air thinner. Phoenix is 1,000 feet higher than sea level to start with, and it's too hot.
But the larger Airbus and Boeing jets are not going to be affected by this, right? They can fly in that,
right,
or they can take off in that heat?
Yes, so larger planes can handle this. Military planes where the engines are built with such thrust that it sort of defies normal physics. But the CRJ, which is a fantastic plane that I've flown on many times, is that compromise between performance and cost. So it doesn't have the biggest engines in the world, and it's those planes that have been told to be grounded.
Well, and do airports airports in hotter places tend to have longer runways as a result of this problem.
Yes, hotter places, you know, big airports in longer places have, in hotter places have longer runways, and airports in higher places. So throughout the Rocky Mountains, you'll find, you know, in the on the East Coast, you might have airports that are typically 2,500 or 3,000 feet for a small airport, 5 to 10,000 feet for a long airport. In the West, you'll see much longer airfields because otherwise they'd be grounding planes on a regular basis. So this is not a common occurrence, but once you start getting about over 104 degrees Fahrenheit, the airlines start to think about these things.
But the idea of flights being canceled because of heat, I mean, does that happen very much?
You know, it doesn't happen often. And you know, I don't know whether one believes in what's going on in the world, but we're getting hotter temperatures, and it's a matter of degrees, and it will start to have these effects. Look, the big Boeings and Jumbos, the Airbuses, they can go to 125, 126. I don't know why you want to be on a plane in that weather anyway. And the other problem is that airports themselves have problems when it's that hot. The asphalt, the tarmac gets soft. Sometimes the planes start to settle in. The tires are rubber. So at some point, it's just too hot to operate.
I just remember on the other end of the spectrum being in Dallas once when it snowed. They're not
Same
really
idea.
Used to that
right.
very much, and they probably had one, you know, a de-icer for the entire
But once you de-ice a plane, airplanes love cold air. So they fly very well in cold air, which is why airplanes like to fly so high. The hot air you can't solve for.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, Energy Secretary Rick Perry said he doesn't believe carbon dioxide emissions from human activity are the main driver of climate change. Here he is answering a question about it on CNBC's Squawk Box.
No, most likely the primary control knob is the ocean waters and the this environment that we live in. I mean, the fact is, this isn't a shouldn't be a debate about, you know, is the climate changing? Is man having an effect on it? Yeah, we are. The question should be, you know, just how much and what are the policy changes that we need to make to affect that? I mean, there's just this science, this idea that science is just absolutely settled. And if you don't believe it's settled, then you're somehow or another a Neanderthal. That is so inappropriate.
Well, that puts him somewhat in line with EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, who made similar comments in March. But it contradicts the findings of scientists at Pruitt's own EPA, as well as NASA, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And it puts him at odds with people living with the consequences of climate change. For farmers in Honduras, climate change is personal. The country has the unfortunate distinction of being ranked third in the world on the list of countries most affected by global warming between 1996 and 2014. Among the challenges, storms, water shortages, funguses. And now farmers say they're also at risk of losing millions of dollars in USAID money earmarked to fight these challenges. Here now is Karen Miller-Metzen, recently visited Honduras and met some of the affected farmers.
Apatoro County is in the densely forested western side of Honduras, a few miles from El Salvador. Its 35 villages are connected by steep dirt mountain roads, many of them impassable during the rainy season. For residents here, life has always been hard. Plumbing and electricity are rare. Poverty is endemic. And now, there's another crisis. I meet up with farmer Jose Santos Martinez Guevara in the tiny town of La Florida. He's been farming coffee here for 45 years, and I ask him what he's seen.
Aquí nos ha afectado el cambio climático.
Cambio climático, climate change. That's what he wants to talk about. It's become a refrain among the region's farmers, and he tells me about it through a translator.
We've seen the climate change here a lot, with there being a lack of water and a lack of potable water from the springs, and we've also seen a big change in the amount of fruit produced. And we've seen a lot of changes because of the funguses that have hit our coffee. Rust is the biggest one.
The rust fungus, La Roya, thrives with warmer temperatures. It prevents leaves from absorbing sunlight. Plants die. In 2013, it wiped out 40% of the country's coffee. The government declared a national emergency. But the rust, he says, isn't the worst of it. There's another plague. That's what the farmers call these setbacks. This one is the southern pine beetle.
We in this zone were very surprised at how fast and how hard this plague hit us. And it affected thousands of trees in this area. And it really, it's a national crisis that we're having in Honduras, not just in this area.
As we hike up a steep rocky road, heading to meet another farmer in the town of El Sauce, he tells us that the loss of trees also caused erosion, landslides, poor quality soil. In 2014, the government literally declared war on the pine beetle, sending troops into the forests with chainsaws. 3 years and 1 million lost acres later, huge swaths of brownish-red trees stand out on the green mountainside. We arrive at the farm where we're met by a farmer and her daughter.
Hola. Fatima.
Dilcia Garcia.
Dilcia and Fatima take us on a tour of the farm, remarkable for its diversity.
Papaya, limón, naranja, mango.
That diversification started a few years ago, after rust destroyed her coffee. But the new crops aren't the only innovation on the farm. Now we're walking down a little hill, and there's little baby corn stalks sprouting up in rows. And a little further down the hill to the left are hundreds, maybe thousands, of little potted plants with irrigation pipes going all the way through them, which is a fairly new development in this very rural and very remote area. Dilcia got help from the U.S. government to install the irrigation system, and also with the education she needed to diversify. The money came through a Honduran partnership with USAID. That's the American agency committed to international development. But under President Trump's 2018 budget proposal, Honduras would lose a third of its USAID money and all of the money earmarked for projects like these. Dilcia says the uncertainty is keeping her up at night.
We are very concerned because we've heard that USAID programs are going to be canceled completely. And so the president on our end of our village with USAID has been working hard to find some ways that we can at least finish what we've already started these past 6 years.
Dilcia says she's not sure where farmers will get the training they need to keep innovating, but that groups of farmers are already trying to find other ways to survive.
So we are always going to be a family of coffee, but we are trying to diversify our crops, and families have to come together to put their resources together, even to create a micro-business.
Dilcia is already trying her hand at micro-business. As we hike back down the hill, she tells us she joined a women's collective to make wine from local fruit, pineapples and oranges. 15 minutes later, we arrive at the home of Jose Roger Lopez. He's a lifelong coffee picker who became a beekeeper after crop failure forced him to travel further and further to find work, trips that were separating him and others from their families.
Yo empecé a trabajar como a la edad de 17 años en un beneficio de café.
He says he was 17 the first time he got to see honey production, so he jumped at the opportunity 20 years later when an NGO offered him seed money and training. Can I see your beehives?
See.
And there are the hives. It's a blue box suspended from a wooden beam on a cement brick wall. And can you tell us about it?
Una colmena está produciendo 25 botellas de miel.
A colony like this will produce about 25 bottles, 700 milliliters of honey, twice a year. And we sell it for 100 lempiras, which is approximately $4.30.
So does this provide a significant amount of your family's income now? Does this help sustain you, or is this just a little bit of extra spending money for your family?
Muy importante.
It's very important. This is a well of economy for us. As there's not formal jobs here, this is one of the ways we have to survive.
Roher is proud of his honey business, but he misses the old way of life, the one before climate-related troubles hit the region.
Hemos estado desde que somos niños, nos han ido formando.
Really, we've been doing this since we were children. My mother took me to pick coffee every time there was the season of cutting coffee.
For Dilcia Garcia, climate change also means uncertainty about the future. She and her husband planted wood trees, trees to sell for lumber, as her children's inheritance.
So because of these problems with the rust plague and the droughts that have affected our agricultural survival here, many people have had to leave their farms, and especially we see this with young people that need to help their families, that they go into the cities, especially to work at just factories or the places that produce clothes, and we see them leaving here and not being able to come back.
A San Pedro, no más.
Now, Dilcia worries that neither the kids nor the wood trees will be there in another decade. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Miller-Medson.
Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is with us now to talk about one of the best fruits there is, Kathy, cherries.
I am with you. I absolutely adore them. They're a little pricey this year so right. far. I mean, I got two huge bags to develop recipes for this segment, and it set me back.
Well, and is this the season for cherries?
It is. I mean, it starts in May, and it goes through August, and I think they just get better and better. I have learned so much about cherries this week. It's been really interesting. There's so many different varieties, and it turns out they're so good for you, and there's so much you can do with them.
What are the varieties? Let's start with that. I remember when I was a kid, we used to pick cherries off of a tree, and they were really sour compared to the cherries that I get now.
Okay, so there's two varieties. There's sweet cherries, and then there are sour cherries. And sour cherries are completely different. You don't generally eat them off the tree. They're primarily used for pie and jellies and jams and for baking. One of the most popular one is called Montmorency, nicknamed the cherry pie cherry, grown a lot in Michigan. And those are also the types of cherries you often see in cans and frozen. And they are very different than the sweet ones that we know that we snack on. They're smaller, and they're a bright scarlet, almost a fire engine red on the outside, and tend to be a pale yellow flesh inside. And sour cherries have a very short season, so if you see them fresh, grab them, pit them, freeze them, and enjoy them all year.
Mm. Okay, so those are some of the sour varieties. What about the other ones?
So the most popular variety of cherry that most people eat when they go to the grocery store is the Bing cherry, which is firm and dark red and very sweet and
named
juicy.
Named for Bing Crosby.
No, it is not. It is named, apparently it was developed in Oregon over 100 years ago and is said to have been named for one of his Chinese workmen.
Hmm.
Not what you expected, right?
Right. And I didn't really think it was Bing Crosby.
But. Well, it's a good story. You could work that story right. for sure. Bings tend to be large and round, and when they're dark red, almost verging on black, they're fully ripe.
Well, and when I enjoy cherries these days, I usually am just eating them and then spitting the pit out, and
yes.
that's that. You have done much more interesting things here, so let's talk about some of them, starting with this salad.
Okay, so this is unusual. You don't tend to see cherries a lot in savory dishes, and certainly you could pit some cherries and throw them on any salad, but I thought, what if you roasted them? So I roasted them at a high temperature, and then I added some balsamic vinegar to kind of give them a sweet, sour glaze, and that's a salad of these balsamic roasted cherries with fresh garden arugula and shavings of Parmesan cheese. And then the juices in the roasting pan become the dressing.
It really gives the cherry a very different flavor.
Isn't
in this
it
mix.
So different? It's not familiar anymore. If I blindfolded you and you ate that salad, I don't think you
would
guess.
I wouldn't be able to figure out that it was a cherry.
Which
I would
is
think it was some sort of sweet tomato or something like
right.
that.
Right. It's sad, but it's also really interesting how you can transform an ingredient. So if you're just so sick of eating raw cherries, this salad, I think, is really interesting and refreshing for a summer salad.
Absolutely.
So that's a savory version of something you can do.
You've also got a smoothie here, or a lassi.
It is. It's a type of lassi. I mean, lassis tend to have a lot of herbs and spices in them. And this is so simple. It's pitted cherries, Greek-style yogurt, a touch of maple syrup, and ice cubes, right? You throw it into your blender, and you get this gorgeous cherry red lassi or smoothie, 5 minutes. I think it's a great summer drink, and the ice cubes thicken it and make it really refreshing.
All right, best part now.
Best part.
What is
the dessert, man? This is called a clafouti, C-L-A-F-O-U-T-I, and it is a very basic French baked custard. So you take a little roasting pan and you line it with pitted cherries, and then you whisk eggs and a little flour, and I add a lot of crystallized ginger. So it's cherry ginger, and I made it yesterday, and I did that not because I'm lazy, but because it tastes better the next day.
It is delicious.
Isn't that
right
good?
Now,
and again,
why does it taste better the next day?
There's something about the custard just sitting and settling, and I think the cherry juices redistribute. I would eat that for breakfast, lunch, dinner, dessert, snack. It works on any level.
This brings us to an important point, which is let's take aside all of the other ingredients that are in this clafouti.
Okay.
Are cherries themselves good for you?
They are incredibly good for you. It's considered an antioxidant in the tart cherries. Vitamin E, vitamin C, fiber. There are some people that think that it will balance your blood pressure. Cherries and cherry juice are very naturally low in calories. They apparently give you all kinds of energy. And the problem with them is they're like healthy potato chips. Once you start eating cherries, have you noticed this? It's really hard to stop, except for the price tag.
Right.
How many cherries can you afford?
Is the bill.
Yes, exactly. But the list of health benefits far outweighs anything else.
Here now, resident chef Kathy Guntz talking with us about cherries, and we will have her recipes and tips at hereandnow.org, especially for this clafouti. Kathy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Life is just a bowl of cherries.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.